The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to The History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme, we'll hear about a newly discovered archive which sheds light on the War of Independence and the Civil War in County Clare. Also,
a certain sense of theatricality and perhaps a bit of good publicity.
I feel that there is a splendid vigour and positive approach in the sincerity with which these students are attacking problems.
We had declared ourselves to be the governing body.
The Gentle Revolution, 50 years on. We'll hear memories of the unrest at University College Dublin in 1969. Plus, the life and times of Buck Whaley, the adventurer and prolific gambler who undertook an extraordinary journey from Dublin to Jerusalem for a wager of £15,000. It's 51551 for your texts and at RTE History Show on Twitter. And we begin this evening in County Clare, where a substantial archive of material, including documents, photographs and maps, has been discovered. It was the personal archive of Joseph Barrett, a member of the Irish Republican Brotherhood and the IRA. It mostly relates to his activities in Clare during the War of Independence and the Civil War. I'm joined from our Limerick studio by two guests. Dr. Paul O'Brien is an historian and lecturer at Mary Immaculate College in Limerick, and Paul helped to rescue the archive when it was offered to the local history society in Kilrush in County Clare. And Dr. Robert Hartigan is an independent historian and researcher who's been helping to assess and catalogue the material in the archive. You're both very welcome indeed to the programme.
Thank you.
Paul, begin by telling us, who was Joe Barrett?
Well, Joe Barrett was from West Clare. He joined the IRB in 1908. His father was an old Fenian. Barrett then joined the Volunteers in 1913. And by 1916, he was a captain in the IRB. Barrett was put in charge of the Guard of Honour given to De Valera in his first appearance in Clare in the 1917 by-election. And by 1920, Barrett was appointed to command the Mid-Clare Brigade. And subsequently, he was on the anti-treaty side with De Valera. His day job was as a rate collector.
OK, tell us then how you came to discover the archive of his papers.
I suppose from being in from West Clare, we knew that the late Mr. and Mrs. Barrett, that would be Joseph Barrett's son, Josh, and his wife, we knew that their house was up for sale. So I suppose we were keeping a close eye on the house. Now, we thought that we were probably going to rescue an auctioneer's archive more so than anything else. So we got a phone call last August. The house was sold. The vendors invited us to come and have a look at the archive. We took out about 250 boxes of material. We literally rolled out filing cabinets. And lastly, we went into the attic. And in the attic, we found about 7 or 8 old suitcases. And when we brought the suitcases downstairs, out came all of the military-related papers.
250 boxes?
Yeah, we reckon about 250 boxes, archival-sized boxes. The house was 2 stories over basement, and absolutely everything was saved.
That's incredible. And have any archivists been looking at this?
I have shown this to colleagues at work in Mary Immaculate College, and I've also shown it to Ken Bergen, in the Special Collections of the University of Limerick, and Kate Manning in UCD, and they've all been astonished by the quality of the material within.
Okay, the two of you have been going through the archive. Give us an idea of what you've discovered so far. What sort of material have you got there?
There's quite a mishmash of material, really. There's Barrett's personal papers. There's from the War of Independence in Clare. There's quite a number of papers. There's different missions that they went on in Clare. There's the anti-treaty official papers, government papers. There's auctioneer. There's a family auctioneer business. There's hundreds of pages of claims, rejections, appeal cases, correspondence with, I suppose, IRA men and women looking for pensions, and a number of these have been put up on the Military Bureau website. But
so this is people who would have been looking for his endorsement for their pension applications.
Yeah, to confirm that they were on active duty and active service. And I mean, he helped, I'd say, extensively every one of them. And we did check the Bureau of Military website and a lot of the Clare stuff. We don't know if they have it and it hasn't been put up yet, but it's certainly not there presently. And like I said, the most interesting, I think, aspect is the official anti-treaty government orders or papers. They're really fascinating.
Yeah, because they come across like the orders or the papers or the documents of a legitimate government, and they would have considered themselves to be the legitimate government.
Yeah, I think that's the first thing that jumped out at me when Paul asked me to help with the archive. We were pulling out these papers and we didn't know what we were looking at, and it has official government headings and you see Oglach na hÉireann, and I think when you think in the context of 1922, who exactly is this, you know, which group is this? And then as you get into the document itself and you see language like the enemy have carried out acts of terrorism and treason, initially we thought, you know, this is pro-treaty. And then as you read on, you learn, oh, hold up a minute, this is actually the anti-treaty side. And like you say, this sense of legitimacy, it's there from the start. And I think, you know, when you look at the Republican movement since then, right way up to present there, it's interesting that sense of legitimacy is there from the off in the documents.
And there's also, there are chilling lists in the archive of people who were marked down for assassination, weren't there?
Yeah, well, there's the Senate in particular, members of the Free State Senate. There's an extensive list. And the order actually says, if I can read from it here, it's dated the 26th of the 1st, 1923. And it states, from the above date, if any of our prisoners of war are executed by the enemy, one of the senators in the attached file marked A, and I must say they have marked A and F, so there's a distinction between the senators. So those who are marked A will be shot as a reprisal. However, they go on to note that factories owned by any of the above mentioned senators will not be destroyed. So that's interesting in itself as well. They have to protect jobs and the economy. They're I suppose, aware of not turning the people against them. But there is an extensive list. I mean, most of them are, for want of a better word, a lot of them are unionists, a strong unionist voice. So you'd wonder how much of that comes into play also. But a lot of them are deputy lieutenants of counties, such as John Bagwell in County Clare, and so on and so forth. And I suppose here in Limerick as well, Lord Dunraven from the Adair Manor makes the list as well. Mm. So yeah, it is chilling to see it in paper.
In black and white, yeah. And also there's material relating to the anti-treaty leader, Liam Lynch, or I think to his death.
There is. There's a five-page typed document that was written or typed by a Free State soldier at the time who was there and who witnessed the event. So he gives a full breakdown of the skirmish and Liam Lynch's last moments. And I suppose an interesting thing that develops within is there's almost an argument of whether they should bring Lynch to a doctor, or whether he deserves to be treated by a doctor or to see a priest. And there's a bit of a dispute from various factions within trying to deny him the treatment or to see a priest. In the end, they relent, I think, but it's a fascinating insight into Liam Lynch's last moments.
There's also a fascinating photograph, Paul, of Eamon de Valera and Charles Lindbergh. Now, you tell me it's Eamon de Valera, but there's absolutely no evidence. You cannot see hardly a square inch of his face, but it is de Valera and it is Lindbergh shaking hands.
It sure is. We are told that it is in Baldonnell Air Base, and it shows de Valera shaking heartily, I should say, shaking hands with Lindbergh and flanked by General Richard Mulcahy. And you're quite right, Miles, you can't see his face. However, the official photograph does show Lindbergh and de Valera. And I hasten to add, de Valera is in his full flight gear, whereas Lindbergh is just really wearing goggles and a very good suit. The photograph is signed Charles Lindbergh and dated 1936.
It is a very interesting photograph. I mean, Dev really looks as if he has been dressed up to the nines, as if he's been told by some of his flying buddies, this is how you need to dress for Charles Lindbergh, whereas Lindbergh obviously didn't bother.
Absolutely. I mean, he looks like he's in ski gear or something.
Yeah,
really.
Well, Dev looks like he's
white,
in ski,
yeah,
ski,
white
ski gear.
Wellington's and the works. But I guess the cameras were going to be there.
Tell us a bit about Barrett's life after the Civil War.
As I said, he's married in 1922. He marries Bridie Ryan of Thurles. And then after the Civil War, He joins the Free State Army when Dev came to power in the 1930s. During the emergency period, Dev, or the government, appoint him as overseer, I guess, of the Irish Coast Guard Service. But post-emergency period, he retires really from duty, and he establishes a successful auctioneering business, which flourished really until his son and namesake Joe died in 2008. However, he remains, I suppose, these days we might call him a consultant. He remains active in that. He keeps a correspondence with Dublin about army drilling, army training. I suppose drawing on his vast experience as from the early 1920s.
Apparently, there's also Nazi propaganda from the 1930s in this collection. Do we know where did that come from? Why? What it's doing there?
Yes, you're quite right, Miles. There is Nazi propaganda there. There is a file containing material produced by the so-called Union for World Veracity and propaganda material produced by Joseph Goebbels in 1939, which, of course, was very anti-Semitic, calling for the destruction of the Jews. How it came to be in the archive, I do not know. There are other hints towards German, I suppose, related material in the archive. For instance, there's a typed list of, quote, German internee students in attendance at university college science buildings. And there's also two documents marked secret. One relates to the description of the strength of German panzer divisions, and the other one relates to the handling of German armoured divisions.
There was also... Now, we have no way of knowing who drew it, but in one of his personal Bibles, there was a swastika drawn. What's interesting is because during the emergency or the war, he was the head of operations for the Coast Guard. So it's interesting in that clearly there was some kind of Nazi sympathies going on, and yet here he is, the head of the Coast Guard for the Defence Forces. So
fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Where will this archive go, gentlemen, and who might use it?
Well, I suppose we are very anxious for it to be hopefully digitised and made available to researchers. I suppose as it relates to the West, we would be keen to keep it in this area. And with that in mind, I have been in touch with the librarian Anya Finucane in Mary Eye, and also with Ken Bergen in UL. So perhaps we might get some projects going whereby we could digitise it. However, that being said, as I said, I've been in touch with Kate Manning in UCD, and perhaps UCD might be donated to UCD, but we're very, very keen for it to be made available to researchers. And it does beg the question, what else is lurking in attics in West Clare?
Yeah. That was going to be my moral of the story. Yeah. Search the attic, folks. Absolutely. You don't know what you're going to find.
Of course, we're going to publish on it. Rob and I are going to publish on it a couple of articles and perhaps a book.
But I suppose, it's so vast, and you just don't know what other material is out there. So we're eager for others to contact us and maybe work on collaborations. And like I said, just get the message out there, get the Barrett family out there.
God knows what, unfortunately, has been lost in some of these house clearances, but least this treasure trove managed to be saved. So well done. Congratulations.
Right, thank
you both very much for talking to us today, Paul O'Brien and Robert Hartigan, to talk about that amazing archive of Commandant Joseph Barrett of the Mid Clare Brigade of the IRA. The archive is currently with the Kilrush and District Historical Society. After the break, we'll be hearing memories of UCD's Gentle Revolution in 1969.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
And we were hearing before the break from Paul O'Brien of Mary Immaculate College, and I just want to mention an event taking place this coming week at that college. The Irish History Students Association is having its annual conference from the 1st to the 3rd of March. It's an all-Ireland event that will see third level history students and early career researchers from all over the country and indeed abroad presenting their work to an audience of undergraduate and postgraduate students, early career researchers and also established academics, as well as many others. with a love of history. And the whole event is taking place in the Tower Building at Mary Immaculate College and is open to the public. And we'll put details on our website, rte.ie/history. A number of events are taking place over the next few weeks to mark the 50th anniversary of the so-called Gentle Revolution. It occurred at the old UCD campus on Earlsford Terrace, which is now the National Concert Hall. The campus was overcrowded and students were being moved out to a new site at Belfield. But when they heard that there would be no library in the new college, they decided to take action. Regan Hutchins went to the National Concert Hall to meet Basil Miller. He was one of a group who took radical steps to make sure the students' voice was heard. And in this piece, he takes a walk down memory lane.
In the middle of last week, a mass meeting of students from University College Dublin decided not to attend lectures for 2 days, but instead to meet in groups to discuss their studies and their life in the university and the relationship of the university with the rest of the community.
We're standing in the corridor in UCD Earlsford Terrace, occupied since yesterday. We're in full control. We've taken control of the president's office, the registrar's office, the secretary's office, the general office.
Now, you've got a photograph here.
And this is me in my role at the time as auditor of the Political Studies Society.
And you are sitting there among lots of different posters and
yes,
things stuck on the wall.
The Vietnam War being prominent there, left-wing publications at the time, and we've the covers of many of the books which influenced us at the time, including some of James Connolly's writings, Karl Marx, of course. Why did we occupy? Why did we barricade ourselves in here? The building had a capacity, or was built, to hold 4,000 students, and there were actually about 8,000 located at Earlsford Terrace. It was actually quite appalling. People were studying in corridors. If you wanted to get a book out of the library, you had to join a queue. Moving between lectures, even, was a chore.
Some of the students merely want practical changes, improvements in facilities. Others want to change the world overnight.
Why were students worried about moving to Belfield? It would seem like a wonderful opportunity, a bigger campus, you know, more facilities.
That's true, but the real problem with it was it became known that there would not be a library. There would be a temporary library so that one could be waiting for a long time to actually get a book, which had to be retrieved from here in Earlsford Terrace. And I think when that became known, it first of all shocked people, and secondly, it enraged them.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, my purpose this evening is to try and analyse the present situation of unrest in the university.
In May 1968, towards the end of May 1968, a group was set up called SDA, Students for Democratic Action. The college officers basically failed to answer questions which were put to them. We were looking really for a kind of participatory democracy in the college, to run the college.
I am a member of SDA. I was one of those occupying last week.
But you also installed yourselves as interim governors of the college.
Brother students, I was a member of the occupiers last week.
Well, yes, that was a tactic which didn't really mean much, but it made for a certain sense of theatricality and perhaps a bit of good publicity. We had declared ourselves to be the governing body and proclaim that the new governing body would have enormous representation of both students and junior staff.
In 1968, when you set up that group, the world was on fire with Vietnam, civil rights issues, there was the crushed Prague Spring. But there were also issues much closer to home that you were engaged with. What were they?
Here in Ireland, the civil rights movement in the north was beginning to emerge and make its points. There was very widespread militancy among workers. And then, as now, there was a homelessness crisis. There was a very large campaign going on in Dublin, basically looking for solutions to lack of public housing, lack of social housing, just as we see today.
I feel that there is a splendid vigour and positive approach in the sincerity with which these students are attacking problems. I feel that this is going to affect the whole of Irish society in a wonderful way if we can stand behind these students.
The campus at Earlsford Terrace closed. Students were relocated to Belfield. You got libraries, facilities out there. Is there a longer legacy from those days of occupation in this corridor here?
There is a longer legacy in this sense. I see SDA, when I look back, as one piece of a jigsaw of many elements seeking change. We feel we were part of a breach in the wall of silence in Irish society at the time, and that in itself unleashed forces which changed Ireland irrevocably since then.
Regan Hutchins reporting there, talking to Basil Miller about the student protests at University College Dublin, which began in late February 1969. You also heard voices there from the RTE archives, voices from a report on the protests on the TV programme 7 Days. And I'm joined in studio by Una Claffey, former RTE political reporter who was a student at UCD in 1969, and along with Basil Miller was one of the founders of the SDA, the Students for Democratic Action. You're very welcome indeed, Una, to the History Show.
Thanks, Miles.
And it was sparked off by, which was more important? The prospect of not having a library or overcrowding in Earlsford Terrace? Because, I mean, Basil Miller talked about 8,000 people being squashed into a facility which was for 4,000 people.
It was a ferment. And there were so many strands to it. And it was inspired by so many things within the college and outside the college that it's hard to narrow it down to two issues and say either or. I mean, the architects had occupied the School of Architecture a few months prior, and that was about a very specific issue. The Royal Institute of British Architects had threatened to take away recognition of their degrees because of a decline in academic standards in UCD. That was crucial for architectural students because they couldn't work without that recognition. So their occupation was focused entirely on that, on improving the standards in their school. But for us, I mean, one of the things that was interesting about the SDA was that it was totally unhierarchical, that it was above all politics. I mean, people from the political parties were involved in it. Rory Quinn, Basil Miller, myself, we were all involved in the university's branch of the Labour Party at the time. But it was very unsectarian. So
it sounds a bit Occupy. It sounds a little bit like the Occupy movement in some senses, in the sense that it didn't have one particular leader.
Oh, no, it didn't have one particular leader. And that was one of the great things about it, because an awful lot of students got very enriching personal experiences out of that and about being able to challenge authority. But there's no doubt but that the move to Belfield was what finally sparked it off. And, you know, the Students for Democratic Action, we weren't a membership organisation per se. We were just a mass movement, if you like. But the mass was rather small. So if there hadn't been an actual issue which affected students in terms of their everyday lives, certainly the occupation wouldn't have happened. And I don't think the SDA would have had the kinds of successes that it did.
And you would have been aware of people like Tom Hayden in the USA, Rudy Dutschke in Europe, but you didn't go down that route because they essentially took on the mantle of, or at least in retrospect, we think of them as having taken on the mantle of leadership of student movements in Europe and in the US.
Well, they were well-known figures in those student movements. But the SDA, I mean, ironically, both the movement in Germany and the movement in the United States was called SDS. Mm. But they were also mass movements. And I mean, the leaders, if you like, became leaders more or less through media attention. But certainly, I mean, that was one of the things, Miles, that was very exciting about it, was the fact that, you know, you were challenging very, very authoritarian aspect of Irish society, which was the institution of UCD. And you, Ireland itself was a deeply conservative place. But there was a lot going on beneath the surface. I mean, there was a movement, for example, to abolish corporal punishment in schools in Ireland, which had nothing to do with the university. Contraception was illegal. Obviously, divorce and abortion were illegal. There were a lot of things going on, as well as literary censorship, as well as all that repression of the Catholic Church. We didn't know the extent of it.
Yeah. One of the other things that Basil Miller mentioned as well was, I think, something that you were involved in, and that was the housing crisis of the time. And that was something that was also of more than passing interest to the kind of students and to the very students who were involved in the Students for a Democratic Action protest.
Well, there was the Dublin Housing Action Committee. You may not remember, but a number of people were killed when tenements collapsed in Dublin in 1963. There were two people killed in Bolton Street, and there were two young children, two girls, in Fenian Street. And the housing situation was dire. So that was another form of activity that was going on. And I was involved in that, certainly. But so were quite a number of students from the SDA. I mean, the likes of John Feeney, Basil Miller. And then, of course, there was the Vietnam War. Mm. And, I mean, Basil and I, for example, were on the big Vietnam demonstration in London in Grosvenor Square.
Which was 68, wasn't it?
Yeah. And Basil and I, with the late Owen Sweeney and John Cahill, were part of the Burnt Tollet March from Belfast to Derry.
Haven't talked about so far is the people's democracy and the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland, because that had already kicked off as well, and that must have been influential.
That was, and that march was in January 69, as far as I recall. About 100 of us set off from Belfast, opposed, by the way, by the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association, because they felt it was too provocative, because we were marching from Belfast to Derry. And I've often asked myself that question since. It was, of course, viciously and famously attacked by Paisleyites at Burnt Tollet Bridge, with the connivance of some members of the RUC, it must be said.
And graphically filmed by RTE cameraman.
By RTE's great cameraman, Gay O'Brien, who actually gave me a lift home. I don't know, we hitched there. Basil and I hitched together, and the other two, I think, hitched separately. But when I got, Gay O'Brien gave me a lift to RTE, and I then got into a taxi to go home to my parents' home. And the
taxi thinking where you would end up.
The taximan asked me, what the hell did I think I was doing? It was none of my business. So that's often my cough somewhat.
One of the voices that we heard on the report there, somebody that I think we both have known well or knew well over the years, when she published, she was Margaret McCurtain. But to anybody who went to UCD and did history, she was Sister Ben.
Sister Benvenuta McCurtain is a wonderful woman. She lectured in history in her Dominican habit.
Yeah, she'd stopped doing that when I was there.
She was still doing it when I was there. And she was she certainly was part of that radical strain of the Dominicans. She was wonderfully supportive. I found her personally incredibly supportive, and I felt very lucky to be doing history, because by and large it was a fairly progressive department. Yes, I think that clip that you have was from Seven Days. But a very fine woman and a very fine historian, and totally supportive of students, and somebody who, you know, was more than happy to talk to students. I remember when I finally graduated with a pass BA, saying to her, you know, I really should have done better and all this sort of stuff, because both Basil Miller and Kevin Myers, another leading activist, both got first class honours in their degrees in spite of being involved in all this carry on. I remember her saying to me, ah, yes, Una, But what'll that matter in years to come? But your experiences here will be always remembered, and so they are.
Wonderful exhibition or example of the paternalism of the 1960s. Apparently there was a ban on female students wearing trousers.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I wore trousers on one occasion when the ban was still there. More for convenience, I have to say, than as a demonstration of radical politics. I was going to a rugby colours match between UCD and Trinity, so it was a Saturday morning when I went in. Nobody paid a blind bit of notice. But there was a day set apart when we female students all wore trousers. Now, I think the college actually was quite intelligent in many respects in terms of how it responded to the gentle revolution. And I mean, they didn't come the heavy in terms of the jeans. The ban just disappeared.
They could have come the heavy. I mean, just listening again to Basil Miller talking about occupying the president's office and the registrar's office. Mm. I mean, one thinks of similar demonstrations in New York and Columbia University, which
exactly.
were broken up. Quite, I mean, heavy-handedly.
By the New York police.
By the police.
Yeah, yeah.
So it never came to that.
It never came to that. And in fact, I was talking to Basil the other day and I said to him, I wonder, is UCD subject to the Freedom of Information Act? Because it would be very interesting to get, I mean, there have been various works published by academics in the college, but it would be very interesting to get the minutes of the Academic Council and the governing body meetings in which our activities were discussed and who took what position in relation to how to handle it. Because the fact that they just let the events go ahead, I mean, there was a strike for virtually 10 days with constant teach-ins and all of that. It did kind of take some of the wind out of the sails. You know, we didn't have a position where we could claim university brutality or police brutality, all of which are very useful charges to be able to make in situations like that. But that was denied us.
Split heads would have gone down well, you mean?
Well, maybe not quite. But I do remember very early on, Basil and Rory Quinn and myself organised a demonstration to Trinity in response to a police attack on a march organised in Trinity against a visit of the King and Queen of the Belgians because of the imperial past of Belgium. And we three organised, that was, the police did deal quite harshly with that, but we three decided that we should have a march to Trinity in solidarity with the Trinity students, because there was a lot of crossover between the two colleges at that point. And I remember Garrett Fitzgerald, a much younger Garrett Fitzgerald, coming to me and saying, "Why didn't you sign the paper?" And it was a very good lesson in...
What was the paper?
Well, the paper was the flyer that we printed off a Gestetner machine in the Labour Party head office across the street. They had their office in Earlsford Terrace at the time, calling on students to go down to march to Trinity in support of the Trinity students. And it taught me a good lesson that if you've something to say, stand behind it and put your name to it. He didn't object to the march.
Yeah, just to the fact that you didn't sign. Mm. What did it all achieve?
Well, I suppose the most obvious immediate effect was the establishment of a proper Students' Representative Council with Eddie O'Connor as its first paid president. He'd been serving as president. And a lot of that was very influential in terms of developing the student movement into the Union of Students of Ireland. So in that sense, that was important. What else did it achieve? You know, these historical questions, looking back in hindsight, what precisely did it achieve?
A lot of great memories.
Points 1, 2, 3 on your exam paper don't necessarily apply. But what it did achieve, I think, for a lot of us was a lot of very good memories, but also a sense of engagement in society, a sense of being concerned about issues beyond our own personal welfare, a sense of comradeship, a sense of solidarity, a sense of the fact that we weren't just irrelevant little people, that we could attempt to take some control of our lives.
What do you think now when you see not students, not university students in the main, but secondary school students all over Europe on the streets protesting about the most important issue which confronts us and which faces us, not Brexit, not Donald Trump, but climate change?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that because certainly when I was a secondary school student, it would never have occurred to me to go out in the streets and protest out of school, even though I came from a very strong trade union family. But
stuff like this, that we're talking about, to some extent creates or has created a template, if you like, which allows those students to say, okay, they were doing it at 18 or 19, you know, 50 years ago. We can do it at 16 or 17.
Well, I think secondary school students now are a very, very different bunch to when we were secondary school students. I mean, they're much more mature, they're much more advanced in years, and they're getting a lot of this in school. I mean, their teachers are talking about climate change, and rightly so. And I suppose, I mean, I've seen them being interviewed in England, and they're very articulate, bright young people. A lot of them young women, I'm delighted to see.
Same in America with the gun issue.
Yes. Although that was so... Yeah, that was caused by such a direct attack on some of those students. But, you know, it does make sense. I mean, the only reservation I would have about that is not about the fact that they are protesting, but that, you know, your whatever you end up with at the end of your secondary school really is your passport to the rest of your life. Mm. And if you don't get a leaving cert or whatever, your chances of getting into third level are virtually nil.
There speaks somebody who has just reminded us that you got a pass BA.
Indeed.
Yeah. There you go.
But I did graduate.
You did graduate, indeed. And you made a bit of a success of what happened afterwards as well. Una,
thank you
very much for joining us on The History Show this evening and telling us about those memories of the Gentle Revolution in 1969. And as I mentioned, there are a number of events taking place to mark the 50th anniversary. This Thursday at 8 p.m. in UCD, there's an event called Characters in Conversation, where activists from the period will talk about the spirit of protest and desire for social change that motivated them at the time. Also, a concert to commemorate the Gentle Revolution. That'll be taking place in the John Field Room at the National Concert Hall on Tuesday, the 12th of March. All proceeds will go to the Peter McVeary Trust. Tickets are €20, excuse me. I'm just bringing me back to the 1969. Can be purchased from the National Concert Hall box office. And we'll put details of those events on our own website, rte.ie/history. After the break, we'll be hearing about the extraordinary life of Thomas Buck Whaley, Ireland's greatest adventurer.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to The History Show on RTE Radio 151551 for your texts. And there was sad news, as many of you would have heard this week, of the death of Professor David Fitzpatrick, the historian whose original, researched-based, challenging work influenced many, many historians and scholars. excuse me, I think the statement from President Higgins following his passing summed it up well when he said he leaves a rich legacy of work. Irish academic life has suffered a great loss with his passing. And I just wanted to pay that very, very brief tribute and to mention that we're going to be discussing David's work, David Fitzpatrick's work, his life and his work far more extensively on next week's programme. Just wanted to note and to acknowledge the sad news of the passing of Professor David Fitzpatrick. Now, you may be familiar with the name Buck Whaley, possibly because there was once a nightclub on Leeson Street in Dublin that bore his name, which had absolutely nothing whatever to do with him. But you may not know that much about him. Well, he was a man who led an extraordinary life, known equally for his adventuring, his huge gambling debts, and a perilous journey that he undertook to Jerusalem and back to Ireland within a year, a serious undertaking in the 18th century. There's a new book out, Buck Whaley, Ireland's Greatest Adventurer. It tells the full story of his remarkable life and adventures for the first time. And the author, David Ryan, joins me now in studio. David, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much, Miles.
Just give us a quick overview. Give us the kind of the bullet points before we get into this in any detail of the life and times of Buck Whaley.
Sure. Well, Buck Whaley was a very wealthy young Anglo-Irish gentleman who lived during the late 18th century, born in Dublin in 1765, and he lived until 1800, so he was 34 when he died. And like many wealthy young gentlemen at the time, he was much given to gambling and self-indulgence and all that kind of carry on. And if he had only been that, and if he'd only done that, we probably wouldn't know too much about him today. But the extraordinary thing about him is that he, in 1788, he embarked for Jerusalem on the back of a £15,000 wager. And he travelled there and back within a year in order to successfully win his bet.
We'll talk about that in more detail in a few minutes. But he was born into wealth and privilege, wasn't he?
He was born into great wealth and privilege, yes. He inherited from his father, Richard Chapel Whaley, he inherited a lump sum of circa £50,000 to £60,000 in their money, which equates to probably something in between 10 and 20 million in today's money. And he also inherited estates in County Carlow.
But he inherited those at a very, very early age. I mean, he didn't come into it until he was, what, 21?
Yeah, he didn't come into it until he was 21, but he inherited it when he was around 10 or thereabouts. But even though he didn't technically come into the inheritance until the age of 21, at a much earlier age than that, he was able to borrow heavily on the back of the fact that he was going to come into all this cash.
So he could begin his life as a rake at a very, very early age.
Very early age.
Tell us a bit more about his trip to Jerusalem. I mean, a £15,000 bet, given that he had inherited something like four times that, which amounts to about 20 million. That's a lot of money. That's a hell of a bet.
Yeah, it is. It's again, it's probably something in the region of a few million in today's money, you know, and it was accumulation of debts that other some of his friends and acquaintances around Dublin, but also people further afield had made with him as to whether.
So it wasn't just one person. It was a number of people.
It was indeed, yeah, a number of people. There was a well-known club at the time in Dublin called Daly's Club. A lot of MPs who would have been in Parliament in the Parliament House of College Green, which is now the Bank of Ireland building. A lot of the MPs would have been patrons of Daly's Club, as Buck Whaley was himself. And many of these people bet with him, but also other individuals
and
as well.
And why was it a big deal in that period to go to Jerusalem and to come back again?
Yeah, sure. So if you or I want to go to Jerusalem, Miles, we go on to Expedia.com or Ryan or whoever it may be, and we book ourselves a flight. But in the 18th century, it's decidedly more complicated than this. You have to travel by sea or by land, and going by sea or by land to the Middle East in the 18th century was an extremely complicated undertaking. By sea...
Not just logistics. Particularly complicated, I presume. It was dangerous as well, wasn't it?
It was very dangerous because, you know, it's a long journey by sea. It took him 3 weeks to sail from Dublin and then to London and from London on to Turkey. It took him well over 3 weeks, actually. But also you could be shipwrecked easily. There were many storms and hurricanes, and you could also be attacked by pirates, or you could be attacked by the hostile fleets of enemy powers. Then when you got to land, Jerusalem obviously is inland. You have to travel overland for a certain period of time. You could be subject to not only the vagaries of the weather and abysmal accommodation, because that was always was all that was available. I mean, he was
it wasn't a tourist trap in those days.
Not in those days, no. You know, you could. It wasn't set up for travel, let alone tourism. So, you know, you could end up in some whatever roadside stable or shack served the purpose.
And God knows what you could catch.
I beg your pardon?
God knows what you could catch, what disease you could catch.
Exactly. And he did, as it happened, fall ill with a fever when he was in Constantinople, which, as people will know, is now Istanbul. He fell ill with a fever that almost killed him, actually, when he was kind of halfway through his expedition. So,
and how do you prove that you've been to Jerusalem and that you have come back again? I mean, he could have just gone to London, lost a few bob on the gambling tables and come back to Dublin and say, yeah, I was there.
Sure, yeah. And of course, he had no social media or GPS or anything to track where he was. So, the way he proved it was there were a number of Christian convents in the Holy Land at that time. There still are, actually, in Jerusalem and Nazareth and places like this. And even though it was under Muslim dominion, the dominion of the Ottoman Empire at the time, the Sultan had given these Christian convents permission to still operate in the Holy Land, and the one in Jerusalem and the one in Nazareth both issued certificates proving that he had been in Jerusalem and in Nazareth on those dates in 1789.
There are lots of myths about Buck Whaley. One of them is, there's a celebrated myth about Buck Whaley and the Wailing Wall. Tell us about that.
Yes, this one, people familiar with old histories of Dublin might have come across it. It's the idea that not only did he travel to Jerusalem, but that he walked there overland, except insofar as it was necessary to go across the sea, which happens to be nonsense, actually. He sailed most of the way. But the other myth is that he played handball against the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, which I would say if you went along there today and tried it, you probably wouldn't get very far.
But I would hope not.
That is a complete myth. There's no mention of it, not only in his own memoirs, but in the journal of his travelling companion, Hugh Moore, which is also still extant. It's actually in a private collection in Istanbul. He makes no mention of it either, so it was concocted, I think, in later years to...
One thing that is not a myth, and which is almost as extraordinary as the notion of playing handball against the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, was he had a plan to save King Louis the 16th from the guillotine.
That's right. Whaley racked up quite a few deaths and had to clear off to France around 1791 and got caught up in the affairs of the French Revolution. And he was in the city early in 1793 when King Louis the 16th had been tried, found guilty of conspiring against the state, and was sentenced to be executed by guillotine. And Whaley came up with a harebrained scheme, not his only harebrained scheme, but possibly one of the more famous ones, that he was going to rescue him from the guillotine. And when he got to the Place de la Révolution, which is the Place de la Concorde now with the big obelisk in Paris, he realised that rows of red, blue-coated soldiers were surrounding the scaffold, that there wasn't a chance he could break through and spirit the king to safety. And he ran off in horror from the scene and found himself in a coffee house where he recorded his feelings at the time, which were incidentally accentuated by the fact that a bunch of Englishmen burst in, covered in the king's blood, with bits of the king's hair and all sorts of things, which they... being ardent revolutionaries, obviously caught up in the enthusiasm of it, and they were showing off as trophies.
He was an MP, and he was an Irish MP. Now, you know, that's nothing spectacular there, because pretty much every wealthy Anglo-Irishman or member of any Anglo-Irish family in those days became an MP at some stage. But he was an MP.
Yeah, he was an MP. But as you say, it wasn't necessarily indicative of a great interest in politics.
He was no Henry Grattan.
Certainly not, no. And like a number of other young MPs, it was kind of, they became MPs for the privilege that the position afforded them, but they were more interested in spending their time drinking, gambling, you know, bit of womanising. And incidentally, it was with a number of those other MPs that he kind of hung out in Daly's Club. And these were some of the guys that best wit him whether or not he could travel to Jerusalem.
Tell us about his relationship with a land agent called Samuel Faulkner. Why is that significant?
It's very significant for the fact, given the fact that Faulkner filed away every letter he had he received concerning Whaley and Whaley's estates, because Faulkner was Whaley's land agent, but he was also the man to whom Whaley turned every time he got heavily into debt or got into some kind of scrape and needed help to get out of it.
And Faulkner kept all this stuff.
It's now.
You must be a big fan of Faulkner.
Well, if it wasn't for Faulkner, we wouldn't know a hell of a lot about Whaley today. And I was lucky enough to get access to the private collection where it's held, and I'm very grateful to the owners for letting me look at it. And it allowed us to fill in a lot of the gaps in Whaley's life.
How did he die?
He died in what some believe to be controversial circumstances, but he was undertaking a journey from Liverpool to London in the year 1800 when something happened on the road, and he was taken in an expiring state. He was brought to a nearby inn on the Mail Coach Road called the Georgian, I think, in Knutsford, which is in Cheshire. And it seems that he had caught a fever. And he'd always been kind of susceptible to feverish illness, which has struck him down a couple of times during his life, and he died there and then the spot. But the interesting thing was that about 20 years later, a story emerged that actually it wasn't fever that killed him at all, that was just invented to cover up the actual really controversial circumstances of his demise, which were that he had been stabbed by one of his mistresses. Now, as far as I've investigated that particular story, as far as I can make out, it's a fabrication, but it's no surprise that controversy was surround Whaley's death when it was something that kind of dogged him all his life.
And he had numerous children, or he had at least three children. Were they all from the same well, it wasn't wife, because I think the person to whom he was married wasn't the mother of those children, so he got around.
Correct, yes. He had five children in total. Four with the same lady. But the first one he had during his travels in France on his grand tour, when he was quite young, actually only 17 or 18, he got a local noblewoman pregnant, and The daughter actually died soon afterwards. And then with in later years, he took up with a lady called Maria Courtney and had four children with her, but they were not married either. He did marry eventually, about 10 months before his death in 1800, but that marriage in that short time didn't produce any children.
But it did produce deaths, and unfortunately, I think people were still pursuing his unfortunate widow for payment of those debts after he died.
Correct, yeah. Before his death, he had managed to... partly by gambling, but partly also by a clever way of playing the political game. He had become an MP again and was back in the Irish Parliament, and he took bribes to vote both for and against the Union, the Act of Union, as people will know, to unify Britain and Ireland after the 1798 rebellion. He made a bit of money that way. He also made a bit of money from his new wife's inheritance. But despite all that, his affairs were in a very muddled state and he left extensive debts behind him.
Okay, in six or seven figures, very quickly, put a figure on it. Do you have any idea how much money he went through in his lifetime?
He himself puts it at £400,000, which is possibly an exaggeration, but from what I have been able to discover from the sources, I would say that it was probably between 200,000 and 400,000, which is still an astronomical amount.
It's about 40, 50 million, isn't it?
It would be between 50 and 100 million
wow.
in today's money.
Okay, right. Thank you very much. The book is called Book Whaley, Ireland's Greatest Adventure, published by Merrion Press. The author is David Ryan. Thank you for joining us on the programme today, David. That's all we've got time for. Details of all items, as well as podcasts, available on our website, rte.ie/history. Thanks tonight to Noel Robertson Sand and our researcher, Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Cansey, goodbye and thanks for listening.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.